This is the 51st edition, I believe, of WFAE Talks. I'm news director Greg Collard, and with me is Ben Bradford, who has not been here for a long time. He informed me.
Well, I mean, I've been here. You just haven't invited me onto the show in a long time.
Well, no. You seem to be conveniently gone on the days that we record.
On the random Fridays we've been doing this. Yeah, true. I have not. But see, I was gone last Friday, and then I think I was out on a story for the last couple of times before that. You know, just doing my job and slowly getting excised from WFAE Talks.
So you think we should have the schedule built around yours?
Yeah, pretty much. Everything should revolve around me.
Yeah, I guess the schedule of this revolves more around me, doesn't it?
Well, you know, you are the host and my boss.
Well,
I don't know where we could find that music. Where we're to look up that music if we were to do it?
That's really the only thing, barring Lisa and I from staging a coup.
You know, in our system, it's called Talks Bed, all right? For the future. You could just type it up. And
now we have
the
power, Lisa.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Talks Bed.
Yes.
And that's WFAE education reporter Lisa Worf.
Yes.
Thank you.
You've been busy with a lot of higher ed in the last week.
Yeah.
Last couple weeks, actually, because I know you took a lot of time working on, I don't mean that negatively. I know you've just been working hard is what I meant.
Well, you should be part of that negatively.
You did a story this week with HBCUs, Historically Black Colleges and Universities, and also worked a little bit with Charlotte Talks on a show they had on the same topic.
Yeah. I visited Johnson C. Smith and took a day up at Winston-Salem State, and I really enjoyed talking to students up at Winston-Salem State. They have a great nursing program. They have students going there for a whole variety of reasons, whether it's they're looking for a historically black schools experience or whether they just want a college degree. So,
and the impetus for the story is basically is some of the challenges these schools are having. What are enrollment is down at many of them. What is their role in this and the challenges in getting students as other PWIs, I learned, predominantly white institutions is a common term.
Uh-huh.
That they compete for minority students now, too, more than they did when HBCUs came about. So
a lot more.
Yeah. They accept them for once. So what are the challenges facing HBCUs and what did you learn, too? About HBCUs through this process?
Sure. I mean, the big challenge is that there are so many options now, right? So back in 1976, maybe about a third of African-American college graduates went to an HBCU. And now it's about a sixth because, I mean, there's all the schools to choose from. Several students I talked to, they said, hey, you know, I went to a high school that was mostly white, and I felt like I wanted to, get a different experience in college and also wanted to see, people who look like me who are in charge. And then, in some cases, you're seeing declining enrollment. For example, when some of these federal loan requirements were tightened a couple years ago, a lot of students that made them ineligible for those loans. And so you saw a lot of students at Johnson C. Smith, which is not a big school here. I think it's about 1,200, 1,400 students. They lost 180 students because of those, that tightening. And then you had this thing in the UNC system where several years ago, they were trying to get more and more people into colleges. And so they expanded, they really pushed several schools on their college, their smaller campuses and basically all of the public HBCUs to accept more students. And so that meant, kind of lowering some of
lowering
the standards. Yeah. And so then, graduation rates went down. And then recently, over the last few years, the UNC system has been gradually increasing their standards. And so that means,
the statistics don't look as good for them, but they were responding to a legislative mandate to take on more risky to take
on. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Winston-Salem State, for example, they say, well, we're kind of right-sizing now. They lost 18%. Their enrollment is down over the past 6 years. But, you know, some of that growth, they had a hard time supporting.
You have anything on this, Ben? We don't have to dominate the discussion here. We welcome you to be part of it,
even though you haven't been here
since March 27th.
Thank you. I feel welcome. No, I feel like that was a pretty comprehensive thing. I mean, was there anything that especially surprised you when you were reporting on it?
I think the amount of students who went to schools who weren't looking for an HBCU experience, that they felt this was, you know, their, you know, especially with the UNC public schools, public HBCUs, that, hey, this was their local four-year college, and, you know, they were going to get their degree through that.
Well, how are they positioning themselves then to compete in general? I know it's different for each school, and there's difference between public and private, but in general, what did you find that these schools are doing to compete for students?
I spoke with Philip Clay. He is he's the former chancellor of MIT, and he's an urban planner who wrote this report trying to figure out, you know, how these schools are going to be able to survive. And, you know, what he basically says is that you need to have an area of excellence, which maybe sounds like, oh, of course that makes sense. But, you know, when you look at the UNC system and when you look at some of the private HBCUs like Johnson C. Smith around here, you see them really building that up, like building a niche up, whether that's the nursing school at Winston-Salem State, whether you have at Fayetteville State. They really cater to veterans. And you've seen some big growth at that school and trying to build up these areas. At Johnson C. Smith, they're putting a lot of money into STEM, for example, science, technology. And they dropped their education program, which, I mean, that was what the school was founded on, because they weren't getting that many applicants. And you also see an outreach to the community more. You know, by their nature, HBCUs were insular, at least, you know, insular within the African-American community, because they formed because they were excluded. Mm-hmm. So now there's a real emphasis to become part of, you know, if you're in a city, to become part of that city. And you see Johnson C. Smith really doing that with, you know, some of the work along the Beatty's Ford Corridor. And also, you know, their folks are on a lot of, you know, city boards these days, you know, city organizations. So you really see them trying to build themselves as an urban institution, you know.
Well, their major gifts officer is on the city council. Al Austin is on the city council.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I feel like you see that, it's kind of interesting that you say that, you know, this idea of them trying to specialize in something, you know, to find something that they're especially good at. Because we see that, you know, outside of HBCUs, we see that with, you know, UNC Charlotte, for instance, right? These schools that are maybe not the, you know, the prestigious school, but, you know, you see UNC Charlotte, for instance, investing in a lot of energy, right? A lot of energy and engineering, you know, having EPIC, a center there that's specifically about it, about, you know, new energy technologies, and you're trying to kind of leverage that. And I think we see that on that level too. And it's interesting because it's kind of the same thing that you're talking about, I think, is how do you, in an increasingly crowded you know, kind of marketplace for universities, how do you distinguish yourself? And particularly if the main thing that's distinguished HCBUs for so long is kind of less a point of emphasis. I'm not saying it's not a point of emphasis, or that for some people, obviously, it's a very serious point of emphasis. But if it's less than it used to be, how do you compete?
Yeah. And I mean, you also hear, for example, I mean, in some ways, it's a very similar plight that women's colleges have faced, you know, as far as, you know, interest and difficulties and, you know, for that matter, small liberal arts school.
All right. Well, you can go online and listen to that report from Lisa, and also you'll go to the Charlotte Talks page and listen to that entire 1 hour conversation, which included the MIT, former MIT chancellor you just spoke of, and representative of Johnson C. Smith and the chancellor of Winston-Salem State.
Yep, exactly.
All right. On to what you've been working on, Ben. I know both of you at first have had a little bit to do with the you've been covering city council over the years, and some of the I know, Lisa, you've covered the controversy over the firing of Crystal Eschert, which the city says was over for violating its social media policy. There was a report out this week that had some questions about how the fire department is operating, whether the culture is as it should be, whether there's a culture of fear or a lot of the accusations. But and it didn't find any evidence that Crystal Eschert was not fired for violating.
No direct evidence.
No direct evidence is the phrase. So what did you all make of this? And she of course thinks it's she maintains that she was that this violating the social media policy was just an excuse that they were mad at her for.
Right. So she said, I mean, you know, if you start kind of the beginning of this thing, I mean, she said some pretty inflammatory stuff on social media, which is that you know, it was after a especially, you know, when you, considering the context of Baltimore and Ferguson and the violence we've seen where you know, black men, you know, killed or injured by police officers and kind of the eruption around that. So she had sent out something on social media that essentially said when a someone who was white had been, I think, killed by police. And she mm-hmm. was and she said some things about, you know, where's the media now mm-hmm. or, you know, where's the kind of the uproar now and those kind of things there. So the fire department dismissed her about that. And so and you're right. She said that that's because she had blown the whistle on
It had to do with a fire building a center that was being constructed.
Yeah. And so you know, the interesting thing about that, there's been a lot of, you know, kind of behind the scene politics on this. I haven't covered this a ton myself. I mean, I know Lisa's done more on it. You know, Tom Bullock obviously did a lot for us. But, you know, obviously the reports are that Carly at one point, Ron Carly, the city manager at one point, told other people not to do an investigation of this or to hold off on an investigation of this. And then they ended up doing these reports. And I agree that the kind of most significant things about this are not that they found that the fire department was clear of liability. It was just they didn't find enough evidence to say that they are guilty. So mm-hmm. so it was lack of evidence rather than a determination one way or the other. Mm-hmm. But they did find a broader culture of fear and, of retribution in the fire department. And I think that what we've seen, you know, Tom had a good sit down with Ron Carly yesterday to get some of the reactions from that, because immediately after the city didn't even say.
That was so weird. I mean, you have a press conference to release this report, and then, oh, no questions.
Right.
You've got to submit them all in writing, and we'll
questions.
Sit.
Yeah, it's a very simple way of handling, you know, something delicate, and they essentially didn't want to wade into it. Now,
my question was partly, I mean, if you're going to do that, though, why not just send it out? Why have a press conference in the first place?
Well, you know? It's because they want to shape the message before you actually start to read it, but they don't actually want to take kind of the tough questions before everybody and be in front of sort of the reporter firing squad. So, you know, I understand the tactics of it. It was unusual, certainly. You know, but I think that in general, I think the takeaways from the report are that that the report found this kind of culture of fear. And that, you know, in terms of Eschert herself and the reasons, you know, for her dismissal, you know, we don't know. I mean, mm-hmm. she said something inflammatory. I think pretty objectively it was inflammatory, whether it required dismissal or not. I have no idea.
Yeah, and you know, some very good legal analysts have said, hey, seems like she would be protected under the First Amendment
She is a public employee.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the thing, because if you were a private employee, you know, I mean, working at WFAE, you know, we as reporters, you know, we have to be very careful about what we say there, and something like that would certainly at least bring you up for review.
Yeah.
And the same thing, true. You know, we see this in Major League Baseball, for instance, right, where, you know, a player gets fined or suspended for something that they say, because your employer can have, right, when they're a public employee, then you all of a sudden, you know, are under that.
You get extra protection.
Well, you're an agent of you work for the government, and the government cannot infringe on your right to free speech. I mean, there are some exceptions, but.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think my takeaways from this are, you know, in terms of Eschert herself, we don't know. We don't know whether they were just kind of flouting that and saying, well, we don't like what she said, and so we're getting rid of her, and, you know, regardless of kind of the dubious legality or constitutionality of that, or if they said, oh, no, this is, you know, so this is a troublemaker for us, and we got to get rid of her. But we do know that there is, at least in this report, it's very clear that there is a larger kind of culture that's problematic in the fire department. Mm-hmm. And so I think the next questions are, what do they do?
Other things, Monday, the city council, or Ron Carley's going to be giving his recommendations on the budget toll.
That's right. Yeah, Monday's a big day for the city of Charlotte. It's going to be essentially, there's an enormous budget hole that they're trying to deal with. This is, when you tally up kind of everything that they're dealing with, there's a, first of all, the elimination of this business license tax. The legislature got rid of it last year, but it kicks in this upcoming budget, and so which is going to be this summer, and all of a sudden the city is going to find itself with about an $18 million hole in its general fund. That's about 3% of the budget. In addition to that, the county's redo of its property tax revaluation, there's going to be less property taxes coming in, and that especially affects the city. They're expecting about $10 million less there. So you're talking about nearly a 5% hole in the budget, and then they already were going to be about 1% short. So that's a significant gap, and they're trying to figure out how to do it. We've covered over the last few weeks the fact that these holes were there and the ways that they're trying to do it. What had happened is they'd been working for almost the whole year on how do we fill the hole, this 3% from the business privilege license tax. How do we do that? And they were most of the way there when I went to the city's council's retreat in January, and then all of a sudden it essentially just reopened again when they found out in March that they're, so this is just a month ago, that they found out pretty deep in the budget process that they were going to have this extra hole because of property taxes. So Monday, city manager Ron Carley is going to give the council his recommendation for essentially what to do. How do you do it? And, things that could include, they've already implemented a hiring freeze. That could also include a freeze on pay raises, eliminating open positions, cuts, across, they've talked about doing a 1% cut across the county budgets, all the different divisions. They've talked about raising the property tax as a possible option. And they're going to have to do something. I mean, it's a big hole. And so you're, in situations like this, you're either looking at tax raises or service cuts.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll see, what mix they come up with
What is council pushing city manager Carley toward?
There's a lot of resistance to raising the property tax. And so I think that they've cautioned against doing that. There's also a lot of resistance, though, against cutting city staff. And there's a lot of resistance against cutting the capital budget projects like the Blue Line or something like that, where they could. So they've looked at some kind of tricks to take, money from a fund and pay for other things from like, the motel and hotel taxes, your hospitality taxes, that, that there's a pool of money there. And maybe we could pay for more services that are currently coming out of kind of the main bank, the main city bank, and use that there instead. Other ways of kind of switching money around to do some of this. But, there's going to be a certain percentage of it where they're going to just have to make decisions one way or the other. So I think that you're going to see them try to find kind of as many little things as possible, places where they can just say, okay, we're going to freeze this certain program at last year's budget. We're not going to raise it up anymore. Things like, out of school time, they're going to cancel new projects that they're expecting to do, like a partnership with the Foundation for the Carolinas for third grade reading. They're planning to not give their money to that.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't say that they're planning that, but that was certainly one of the proposals. I think you'll see them take up as many of those as possible. And then at the end, they're going to have to figure out, unless they found some magic trick, they're going to have to figure out, okay, what do you do finally? And it's kind of the classic, it's kind of the classic political dilemma, right? Mm-hmm. People like their services and people like low taxes. And when you mess with either one of those, then, there's a lot of resistance to it. So I think that's what the city council's facing. And the other part of it that's really frustrating to them is they feel like they're not responsible for this. They feel like they're responsible for dealing with the ramifications of it, but they didn't cause the property tax revaluation to get botched and then the state law that said no redo it, and they didn't the state passed that. So there's a lot of frustration there, and it actually makes it harder to kind of pull the trigger on something.
I meant to ask you this earlier, but can you cover this Monday night?
I'll cover it Monday night.
Okay, great. Thanks. another neat story you had this week. It's just you went to a Marshall steam plant, Duke's Marshall steam plant, and Iredell County, and just learned about outage season.
Outage season. Who knew? I mean, it makes perfect sense. Essentially, spring and fall are the times when we're using less energy. We're not using as much on heating or on cooling. And so that's, you know, it's less kind of across the board. And power companies across the U.S. use that time to essentially do maintenance. I describe it kind of like giving your car an oil change in the story.
Yeah, I really appreciated that. That's just going pop in.
Yeah, you know, you're expecting the timing belt, and you know, and adding in, you know, flushing out the system, and mm-hmm. you know, the coolant system, and whatever else. So they're doing the same thing. They're climbing up into into where the coal is actually ground up, and you know, and all those different places. Not across the entire. They shut down. You know, Marshall, for instance, has 4 units. And so they shut down one of them. It's one of their biggest ones. And they're sort of, you know, major, if you think about like your, to mix my car analogies here, you think about like your 30,000 and 60,000 mile checkups, right? You have different things that have to happen on each one. Well, like every 2 years, they do less significant work on various units. And then about every 5 or 6 years, they really open the thing up. So that's what I was seeing. So actually, you know, you think about a coal plant and the way it works, of course, is it's almost like an old steamship, mm-hmm. right? You burn the coal, and that creates creates heat that boils water and turns it into steam. And as opposed to powering a ship's rotors, it's actually very similar. It's actually powering a turbine that then turns this magnet, and then magnet spinning creates electricity. And so the magnet is actually missing. It's kind of this disturbing sight. You go in there and you see the generator, and it looks like this like science fiction thing, something out of like Stargate or something like that, and it's hollow in the middle, and it's because they've taken the magnet out, and actually like GE engineers are inspecting it to make sure that that everything's kind of ship shape so that the thing can keep running. And they do this not just for coal plants, but also for gas plants, nuclear plants, hydro, all those different kinds of things. And so right now, about 20% of Duke's fleet is down, and that still leaves them, they say, plenty to not only handle our general energy needs, but if there's, you know, some kind of spike, they still have a lot of backup generators.
Yeah, and so you were touring this plant. You had hard hats on. You were probably hard going
hat,
through
earplugs,
all this
goggles, all those things.
This equipment, navigating yeah. your way. Were you ever worried about your safety?
I'm constantly worried about my safety, Lisa. No, it was, it felt good. I mean, they told us, you know, to watch out for things. Oh, I see what you're saying here. We actually got told starting out before we went in, they gave us the safety tips, and they're like, yeah, you know, watch where you're going. Like, don't get hit by like cranes, or, you know, like, don't just be like looking at the sky when somebody comes over. Yeah, exactly. All those kind of things there. But they also, and this has to be a liability thing or something. Maybe it's just like the engineer's mind, but one of the plant managers who was going with us on a tour also told us we're in this sort of kind of office space, you know, these like plastic tables and chairs. And he says, and you know, watch out, make sure you don't trip on any chairs as you're walking by. And if you sit down, make sure you don't pinch yourself on the tables.
What?
So these are important safety,
you know, the
features
tables that are,
to be aware. Yes.
That are right next to each other. The seams are lined up.
Right. Yeah,
you don't want to
sit down
and
do that. So it's good advice. It's good life advice. I appreciated it. That's what Lisa was really asking about. She wanted me to tell about that.
Well, you turned it a good story. I thought it was. Neat stuff to learn about. I know next week you'll be on the budget trail.
Yes, sir.
All right, Lisa, you're going to be on. Anything good coming up in education? Anything interesting? What are you working on?
I'm working on how to choose the next CMS superintendent and the things that go into that. And I'm also hoping to get into an advanced placement classroom next week to see how they're using some digital tools that Davidson is trying to figure out.
All right.
Very cool.
Yeah. Sounds good. All right, guys. Number 51's in the bag.
It's good to be back, Greg.
All right. Glad to have you.
51.